The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
What for some people is the most incredible sound in the world is for other people mundane. And I'll give you an example. Imagine that it's a really hot day and you're tired and you just made it through the Sahara Desert. I mean, you're talking hot. Talk hot, right? Why go halfway? There is one sound that you long to hear. And this sound, right? Tremendous sound, right? Some people long for a different sound. I want to tell you one of my favorite sounds. This is one of my favorite sounds. You ready? Listening carefully? It's a tremendous sound. Listen to it again. Ah. I once was walking through Mea Shearim. And I happened to walk into a Sfarim store, a Jewish bookstore. And it wasn't, you know, Jewish bookstores in general, so they're a little different than the average store. And unfortunately today they've become more commercialized. You know, if you walk into Mea Shearim, if you walk into the, I don't know, call it the ultra-Orthodox neighborhood, you already know that I have no idea what that means. I think I'm ultra-Orthodox. I'm sure everybody thinks they're ultra-Orthodox, but whatever. But you walk into Mea Shearim, and one of the things that you start to notice is the window displays, or the lack of window displays. Like, if someone has a dress store in America, they'll take beautiful models of, you know, made of clay or whatever it is, and they'll put the most magnificent garments on them, and they'll drape them just right, and they'll put a lot of thought into how I draw a person into the window. I remember, you know, I was growing up, I grew up in a traditional home, I was never into Christmas. But one thing that was nice was the windows. The windows around December in America are incredible. And I remember, I think it was Lord & Taylor's, but I might be wrong, but there's some great store on Fifth Avenue that had the most incredible window displays in New York City around Christmas time. Which one was it? Saks Fifth Avenue. Oh, unbelievable. It's not dresses, like all sorts of scenes. Unbelievable. Like, tremendous, right? And as a matter of fact, when I was back one year with my kids, I specifically went to take them to see the window displays. Like, you know, people thought I was a little nuts. Like, you're spending the afternoon with your children to take them to see some windows. Yes, incredible. Israelis. Okay, right? But in Mea Shearim, you don't see that. If you have a dress store, what's in the window? They'll hang a few dresses. And if you have a food store, right? So they'll put some cans in the window. So I once asked somebody, why don't you put a little effort into your window display? People will actually come in, you'll make more money. And I look at the guy like, he's silly, you know, it's so obvious. So he looks at me like, I'm silly, what do you mean? Why would I do that? And I say, well, because, you know, if you put a beautiful window display, people will come in, it draws people in, it lends something to the neighborhood. He says to me, listen. He says, you know what the problem with advertising is today? The goal of advertising, this is his words, not mine, because I don't know if anybody here is an advertising executive. But the goal of advertising, right? Why do people buy things? People buy things because they want them. And the goal of advertising is to make you feel that what you want is what you need. But what you want isn't always what you need. So if I put a magnificent, beautiful looking dress in my window, right? Then people start to think, I want that. And pretty soon they convince themselves that they need it and they buy it. He says to me, you know, that's theft. That's theft. That's gneva. Gnevat dat. I'm stealing someone's time and I'm stealing someone's perception. So me, I just want people to know it's a dress store. If they're looking for a dress, they'll see the dress. They'll know it's a dress store. But if they don't need a dress, why should they come into my store to get one? Whole different way of a whole different perspective. And when you start to think about it, it's magnificent. Why would I assume or mislead someone into buying something that they shouldn't buy? That's not fair. So now, the ultimate example of this is the old-fashioned traditional Sfarim stores. Jewish bookstores. look at a modern store, even a modern Jewish bookstore, I mean, you're walking, and don't, God forbid, take this to mean that I have a negative opinion of this, because I think it's also a wonderful thing. People come in, they see the Jewish bookstore, draws them in, they buy a Jewish book, they gain tremendously, so I think it's a legitimate thing. But you walk in modern Jewish bookstores, so you'll see they have the displays, and let's put the, you know, I once asked, I won't say where, but I once asked a person who sells Jewish books, how do you decide what to put in your window? So he says, well, the first thing I go with is color. Like bright colored books, that's good. Like, you would think that what do you put in the window? The thing with the most incredible content. How do we buy a book? Well, the first thing is what color is the book? What does that have to do with the book I'm buying? Absolutely nothing. But okay, you go to an old farm store, and what do you see? And these are the ones I look for. If there's a window at all, or a door, there's just a pile of books. That's all. Why? Because those are the ones people are reading, or the store owner is working through, and he puts them in the window. So I go into one of these bookstores, and I see this person, and he's nowhere to be found, right? There's an empty counter in front, and I walk into the store, and there's Sfarim, and I'm looking, and there's no one there. And I say, hello, 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 right? And there's no one there. And after a couple of minutes, I hear a sound, right? And the sound is coming from the back of the store. No, I'm a bekiva, ho. No, fact toisves, ho. So I already know this sound, right? They're learning. Somebody's learning. So I walk back into the back of the store, and I find this guy, and he's like the parrot. He's the epitome, the stereotype. He's an old Jew, right? Long beard, the whole deal, right? He's got his shirt sleeve rolled up, suspenders. He's sitting on a table, poring over this particular text that happened to be a Talmudic text, right? Shalom Aleichem. It happened to be a Talmudic text. And he's learning. And I said to him, excuse me, do you know, I'm sorry to interrupt you, you're learning, but do you know where the store owner is? He goes, oh, that's me, hang on 1 second. He goes back to his learning. Thinking like, you have a store, here's a customer, you might be interested in whether he wants to buy a book, but okay, the guy's learning Torah. So I wait a minute, I wait 2 minutes, I wait 5 minutes, right? So this is a unique experience for me. So finally I said, listen, I really don't mean to interrupt you, excuse me, but I'm not just asking you a question, I want to buy a book. He says, what the heck, just a minute. He goes back to what he's doing. I waited another 5 minutes. Now I'm fascinated. Who is this guy? Is he really the store owner? So it happened to be that I had the time. So I waited and I'm watching and I'm looking at more books. And finally he comes out, right? Big smile on his face, right? I figure he's going to say, I'm really sorry. Didn't mean to keep you waiting. He says to me, oh, oops, Akasha, right? I got a good question, right? So I said, excuse me? He says, yeah, on the chiddush. And I got a good chiddush. I got a good idea. He was learning something. Couldn't figure it out. And he was trying to figure it out. And then he figured it out. So then he came out. So I said to him, look, I got to ask you. Don't take this the wrong way. You know, you're an older gentleman, whatever. But I got to ask you. You have a store. And you're sitting in the back learning. Is there like a partner? Did he leave? No, this is my store. No. So I said, well, why would you be sitting in the back learning if you have a store and there's nobody in the front? First of all, somebody will come in and take your books. He looks at me like I'm mad. He said, why would anybody want to learn Torah? Or, I don't remember exactly how he put it, but basically he said to me, if somebody wants to learn Torah, they wouldn't imagine stealing a book to learn Torah. It makes no sense. So I said, okay, that's a good point, right? So then I said to him, well, why didn't you stop what you were doing? I'm selling a book. He says, listen, you got it all wrong. He says, you think that I opened up a bookstore because I want to sell books and make money? He says, no. He says, I love books. I love to learn. But I have to make money. So I figured out that if I open up a bookstore, I can sit and learn all day because I'll be surrounded by books. So he says, sometimes when I finish what I'm learning, if there's someone here, I'll come, I'll sell a book. I like it. Whole different perspective. So this guy fascinated me. So I'm talking with him and I walk back and I say, can I see what you were learning? What sugya you were learning? And I pick up his volume of Talmud. It was Masechta Shabbos. It was a tractate of Shabbat. And I see that the pages are moist. Right? So I'm trying to, like, you pick something up and you notice that something isn't quite right. And I pick up this sefer, I pick up this book, and I notice that it's like, it's moist. And I, you know, I'm looking around, and I look up at the ceiling, and I don't see anything dripping. And then I'm thinking, maybe he does. I've sometimes seen people in yeshiva do this, you know, they learn quickly, right? You know, so I think maybe that's it. But you don't do that with Talmud. Nobody learns Talmud like that, right? It's just like, let's spend a week on this page. It's not, you know. And I see it's all moist, and then I turn back a few pages, I see it's not. So I said to him, you know, I see your book is all wet. So he looks at me and says, ah. He says, that's what I'm learning today. So I still don't get it. Right? I'm still living here thinking that I'm the one who has it and he's the one who doesn't. Right? So he looks at me like he doesn't get it. So I said, well, why is it moist? He says, what do you mean? I told you, this is what I'm learning. This is what I'm learning. So I said to him, okay, yeah, but why is it wet? So he looks at me again. He says, what do you mean? He says, look at what I'm learning. And I look at the tractate, right? Masechta Shabbos. It's a whole discussion about the relationship between God and man and Sinai and sin. And I said, look, it's a great Gemara. It happens, you know, that you happen to find one that I happen to recognize. It's a tremendous Gemara. It's a tremendous Talmudic discussion. But why is it wet? He looks at me. He says, you could read a Gemara like this and your page would stay dry? That's what he says to me. Now, I want you to know, if a 25-year-old said this to me, I would be a cynic. If a 50-year-old said this to me, I'd look in his eyes to see if he meant it. You'd have to see this guy to understand that the minute he said it, I understood. He says to me, you could learn a page of Gemara like this, and your page stays dry? He was crying over the Gemara. He says, how can you learn Gemara and your page stays dry? Now, I want you to know something. I have never been on the level to learn a page of Gemara and to wet my page like that. But in my mind, that person set for me a goal. How do you do that? How do you fall in love with a book? How do you turn learning into a journey of discovery? How do you reach a stage where this becomes like oxygen? Where you can't let it go. You want to do an incredible experiment? Incredible experiment. Don't do this. But if you did this, walk into Me'ah Shearim with a chumash. This is a chumash. Okay? You want to test physical prowess on the beaches of Tel Aviv. What do? Right? You put a girl in a bikini. Right? You have her play volleyball. And you have her hit the ball too far away and look at it. Right? And there's a few guys there, and you'll see which one is the fastest. They'll run to get the ball. How do you make such a test in Me'ah Shearim? Right? Walk through Me'ah Shearim and drop a chumash. Just put it under your arm and just drop it on the floor. Watch what happens. People see you drop a chumash, and they'll dive. You know, it's like the wide world of sports, you know. Right? I mean, it's just a book. I mean, it's printed on paper. How do you fall in love with a book like this? What is this book? And I want to tell you what we're going to do in this particular series, and I think if I'm not mistaken, we have four classes, is to pick four books. And what I'm looking to give you is a taste of what this book is. It's a little different from what we were doing this morning, which is the study of Chumash. Specifically, the book that we call the Torah. We're going to do one, I believe, on the Siddur, on the prayer book. What is the Siddur? How does it work? How can I develop a relationship with it? We're going to do one on mitzvot. How do I discover mitzvot? And I think we're going to do one on halakha, on Jewish law. Or ethics. I have to take a look which one we... So, here's an interesting question. Okay? And I would tell you, by the way, one last piece of food for thought as we get into this. What I'm looking for, as with every other class that I teach you, is obviously not to resolve this question, but to whet your appetite. But I will tell you this. Any form of study, any book, and this to me, and now I'm just sharing with you my perception, is much more than just a book, changes from a book into a companion by virtue of the relationship that you develop with it. I'll tell you that again. You change a book into a companion by virtue of the relationship you develop with it. This is not just a book I put in my bag. This is a partner. This is someone I have a relationship with. How can I develop a relationship with learning? How can I reach a stage in learning that if I'm not learning, I feel something's missing? So let's take a look at this. Now you might think it's a little strange that we've picked one book and we're going to call this a Jewish books class in a particular book, and here I walk in with a whole pile of books. It's a little strange. As a matter of fact, what's even stranger is that this isn't even the beginning of the umph of a percentage of the books that we would need, which could fill this room to give us a perception of this book. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to introduce you to a few tools. Let's assume that I succeeded my goal. And let's assume that at the end of our class on Chumash, that you actually decide you're interested in pursuing studying Chumash on your own. It doesn't matter to me at the moment how, in a program, out of a program, with a friend, through the computer, internet, you can do it, however you decide to do it, right? One of the frustrating things has always been for me that at the end of the program, there's always a student who comes over and says, you know what, this is great, very interesting, fascinating book, I see I can gain from it, but what do I do now? How do I do that? So part of that I will give response to in the course of our series of classes. But that a person should leave Israelite and not know what a Siddur is, not know how they can develop a relationship with a Siddur, which is a much more difficult question, right? Personally, to me, pains me. So I won't do this every program, but that's the experiment we're going to do this program. Okay. So let me give you an idea of what this book is and how it works. And I want to tell you that I'm staying away for the moment from many of the ethical ideas and the messages of this book, because that we're going to cover in our Chumash class. I will not stay away from those things when we get to the next three books. But I'm going to use this as an opportunity to share with you some tools and some helpful buddies that can get you more into this book if you should so choose ever to do so. So let's start from stage one. This is a tremendous, tremendous... Well, first of all, before we even get into what makes this particular volume tremendous, right? So let's clarify something, okay? When I say that this book is the Torah, that's true and it's not true. And you may have heard this and not quite have a perception of what that means. In fact, when I refer to the Torah, I refer to two things at the same time. On the one hand, I refer to five particular books that we mentioned this morning, right? Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. The five books. And that's called the Chumash, right? Or the Torah. And that's actually the unit that we'll assume for the moment, you shouldn't, but I will, was actually given to Moshe by God at Sinai. Call it divine revelation. And that was what the Jewish people entered the land of Israel with. With the Torah. And that Torah is those five books. But there are two additional portions to this particular book that we call Torah. One of them is called Nevi'im, the prophets. And the other one is called Ketuvim, the writings. Without going into too much detail, because this is part of another part of this course of Jewish books, right? And you can find this, by the way, and that's one of the reasons why we have this particular volume here. If you look at the beginning, you'll find it says Torah. Okay? And you don't have to do this right now if you don't want to, but you can if you want to. And you'll see that it lists the five books. And then if you look at the end of the fifth book, which in here, and if you're ever curious and you forget this, you can come over to me and ask me. It's pretty easy to find. Right? If you look at the end of this section, so you'll find something called the prophets, Nevi'im. And it lists who these prophets are, what these books of prophets are, right? You have the book of Yoshua, of Joshua, the book of Judges, which includes the story of Samson and of Gideon and of Barak and Deborah, etc., right? And then you have the book of Shmuel of Samuel, which is the first great prophet beyond the story of the Judges. This begins really the story of kingship in the Jewish people. King Saul, King David. Then you have the book of Kings, which is the list of the kingdoms as they developed from Solomon, really from the death of David, right? The splitting of the two kingdoms, up until the destruction of the first temple. And then you have specific books of prophets who had prophecies that were so great and so long that they were made into separate books. Jeremiah, Isaiah. Jeremiah, for example, was a prophet who prophesied at the end of the first temple. So was Yeshayahu, Isaiah. And you have 12 minor prophets, etc., 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 right? The 12 minor prophets, which are called the Shenemasar. Oh, I forgot to mention, actually, Yechezkel, Ezekiel, who was the only prophet, interestingly enough, who went down into Babylon, into exile. And then I have 12 minor prophets, Jonah, Micha, whatever, without going into all of them. And you can look this up on your own. By the way, I will mention to you two tools if you should ever decide to study the prophets. One of them is a series by Judaica Press. Tremendous, tremendous series by Judaica Press, which has a volume on every book in the prophets, and for that matter, the writings. It is very, very valuable, right? Well, okay. The second is Art Scroll. Now, there are many other commentaries, but for the moment, I'm what's within our grasp. Art Scroll also has a magnificent commentary on these books. You would be amazed how many people have spent years and years studying Talmud and have never opened up the book of Jeremiah, of Isaiah, of Yechezkel. Some of the prophecies that are contained in those prophets are so incredible, so magnificent, so beautiful, heartrending, moving. And they're meant to be studied before we ever get to Talmud. And so many people have never opened them up and don't know what they're missing. If you ever decide that you want to begin to study your heritage, your history, who we are and how we got here, going through the prophets is a magnificent thing to do. Now I would mention, and I'm going to get back to Torah in a minute, okay? But this is the prophets. Remind me in a moment that the order of study is not a simple question. Remind me. And then the next section, the third section, after I have the Torah and the prophets, the Nevi'im, is something called Ketubim, the writings. Now the writings, again, you can find a list of what the writings are, because they're at the end of the prophets. The Tehillim, the Psalms, Mishlei, the book of Proverbs, the five scrolls, the book of Ruth, and of Esther, and of Lamentations, and of Ecclesiastes, right? What am I missing here? And of Esther, right? The books of Daniel, and of Ezra and Nehemiah, and the book of Chronicles. Now you could imagine that I could spend the next three classes detailing what these things are, who they were written by, how they were written, why they were written, what I can learn from them, why they're separated in these orders. Okay? And this brings me to my question of the order of study. Because I'll be honest with you. If a person is sitting down, there are certain objective perceptions I can share with you based on what little experience I have in the yeshiva world. If a person is sitting down and studying the book of Daniel and has never studied the book of Genesis, something's wrong. On the other hand, if a person is studying Psalms, which is in the third section, and has never studied the book of Kings, I'm not so sure something's wrong. There you could pick either one. How do you do this? So I want to give you Benny Friedman's order list. And if you get 1/15th of the way through this list, then you will be a happy person. Okay? I'm still not all the way through this list. It would seem to me that people make a mistake. Maybe this is because of the way we're trained. I'm not sure. How long would you say it takes to finish the five books of the Torah?
A year.
A year.
Depends on how you're reading it.
How are you learning it?
Well, you tell me.
You have to learn,
A year. Okay, that's interesting. You do it every year, right? Let me ask you a question. Because you're going to hit it, you hit it right on the nose. I have a portion of the week that I read every week when I go to synagogue. Well, I finish it. What should I do the next year?
Read it again.
I should start the prophets. No?
No, because you have to read the Torah each time over again.
So when do I do the prophets? When do I go through a section of prophets every week so that I finish that? But you don't do it. You pick certain units of prophets, and not only prophets, by the way, which you read as an addition, a certain chapter here and there. And that was a whole different reason. That was done because in the time of the Second Temple, the beginning of the Second Temple, the Romans were persecuting the Jews. They forbade the study of Torah. So the rabbis didn't want us to forget what the portion of the week was. So they picked one particular topic of the prophets that resembled the main topic of that weekly portion. And we started reading those every week. So, for example, if it was the week where I would have read the portion of the Ten Commandments and the Revelation at Sinai, so since I could no longer, I was forbidden by Roman law on pain of death to read from the Torah, so I read the section of Ezekiel where Ezekiel describes this incredible image, this fiery image that he has of God. That's his revelation. Once we started being able to read the portions of the week again, right, so then we didn't really have to read the prophets, but since we'd already done it for a few hundred years, so we kept doing it. And don't get me wrong, you can learn a lot about the rabbi's impression of the weak portion by what they chose in the prophets, but it doesn't cover even 5% of what's in the prophets, even 2%. So how come I don't read every week the prophets, go through all the prophets? When I finish going through all the prophets, then I go through all the writings, and then when I finish all that, then I'll go back and start Torah again. Yeah?
What's the weekly section called?
Parshat?
It goes with the
Parshat. Oh, the Haftorah. Right. Hey, pay, Tet Resh He, Haftorah, the addition, the addendum. That's what it's called. H-A-P-H-T.
From the prophets
at the end of the weekly portion in Shabbat morning in the show. But so how come I'm not doing this? So I will tell you what people say, and then I'll tell you what I think. People will tell you, well, because there's a fundamental difference between the five books of Moses and the prophets. The five books of Moses, supposedly, according to our tradition, was given directly from God. As it wasn't as though there was a perception of it, but in fact, God directly spoke these words or told Moses to write them down or however you want to think it. So therefore, each word in the five books of Moses is a word that comes straight from God. Prophecy is different. Prophecy is an idea that's given over to a prophet, but the prophet himself affects that idea and passes it over to the Jewish people. That's why there's something fundamentally different between Moshe, Moses on the one hand, and the prophets on the other. Moshe was considered the perfect vessel. And he was capable somehow of transmitting, you know, what happens when I give a message to Esther over here? So if I give Esther the message directly, she knows she got a message from me. But if I tell Eric here to pass it on to Ronli, and Ronli tells Alex, and Alex gives it to Esther, so you've played this telephone game when you were young. By the time Esther gets it, it's not exactly what I've given. So if I'm getting something from Moshe, how do I know that I'm really getting what God said? That's what made Moshe unique. And you can analyze that and philosophize about how that worked. Some claim it was a miracle, it was a gift that God gave to the Jewish people, because we aren't capable of hearing something on our level directly from God in this world. So there was a human being that was capable of giving something directly from God without giving it directly from God. So I'm not going to get into all that. That's one way that people suggest is a difference. There was a difference between Moshe and Jeremiah. So the five books are different. That's why I read what they have every week. Fine. The five books are what I was given at Sinai. Okay, I can understand that. I think it's a little deeper than that. And I'll tell you one thing I saw in the Maharal that I mentioned this morning. The Maharal of Prague says a tremendous thing. He says what the Torah is trying to tell you is that you never finish. You never finish. Sometime in the fall, right at the end of Sukkot, we actually finish reading the five books on a specific holiday called Simchat Torah. And we get to synagogue and we're all excited because now we're going to read the final books, the final verses of the Torah. All excited, right? At the end of Zot HaBracha, La'enei Kol Yisrael, the eyes of all Israel. Chazak, chazak, v'nitchazek. There's a special verse that we cry out. Strong, strong, and let us become even stronger. Whatever we've learned from this, let's add to it, right? Now, what do I expect? We just finished the five books of Moses. This is great. Break out the party hats. Let's have a party. You know what the Jews do? They just start bracing it right over again. Unbelievable. In fact, if you're ever in a synagogue where the guys who are organizing the service aren't on the ball, and they only have one Torah scroll, so what happens at this point, right? Well, they got to roll the Torah all the way back to the beginning. So most synagogues have two, so they just slip it. You don't sense it. But right away, what do you mean you finished? I once made the mistake of telling somebody I had finished a tractate in the Talmud. And I made the mistake of telling one of the Rebbeim, one of my teachers in the yeshiva where I was studying, that I actually finished Bava Metzia. I went through it. He said, oh, you went through it? I said, yeah, I finished it. It was a great feeling. He says, well, if you still think you finished it, then you haven't even begun it. Go back and start over again. So I thought he was kidding around. You know, like, yeah, okay. Next day he comes over to me. I'm sitting down. So he takes a look over his shoulder. He goes, did you start? So I look at him like, he says, just start. He says, if you finished your Masechta, if you finished your tractate yesterday, you didn't start it again right away, then you haven't learned anything. Start. Very powerful message. So I want to tell you why I'm telling you all this. Because I think this is one of the essential tools of study. The Torah, at a certain point, it's actually mentioned to Joshua, but the Torah at a certain point gives me over the mitzvah. Let's define for the moment, we don't have time to get into this, that's another course I gave it last program, but let's define for the moment the concept of mitzvah, not as commandment. That's how we look at it, from our limited perspective. Let's look at it and define it for the moment, for the purpose of this discussion, as opportunity. Don't think of Shabbat as a commandment. Think of Shabbat as an opportunity. Right? Ultimately, God says, you know what? I give you a world. You have an opportunity. I'll call it Shabbat. You don't want to do it. Is there a problem? But here's your opportunity. You have another opportunity. Give charity. You look at it as a commandment. You look at it as an obligation. That's your loss. I'm telling you it's an opportunity. Okay. So the Torah gives me an opportunity to study Torah. It's funny. You would think one of those basic things in the Torah is to study Torah, but you don't find it as often as you would expect. How does the Torah tell me to study Torah? It says, V'hagita bo yomam v'alayla. You should hagita in it, and I'll get to what that means. You should hag in it. No relation to that word, although you never know, right? In it, yomam v'alayla, day and night. L'hagot is to pour through it, to struggle with it, to agonize over it, to toss and turn with it. There's a beautiful statement in the Talmud, yagata, velo matzata al tamin. If somebody comes to you and says, yagata, I struggled with something, I didn't find it, don't believe him. Because if he'd really struggled with it, he'd find it. Lo yagati v'matzati al tamin. If somebody says, you know what, I didn't even have to struggle for it and I found it, don't believe him either. Because if he hasn't struggled with it, he hasn't really found it. Yagati u'matzati, I struggled and I found him, you can believe. Torah says, you want to study me? Struggle with me. And the Torah says, struggle with me day and night. Now what does that mean? There are two ways to look at that. One way to look at that is to say, all day and all night. It's 3 a.m. in the morning. Where do I have the audacity? Where do I have the gall not to be studying Torah? I mean, imagine if President Clinton, Bill, comes by Israelite, says, listen, I've written a memo to you, Binny. It's very important. I want you to read it and get back to me as soon as you can, even this afternoon. And I see it's a 15-page memo from Bill. I would say that on my daily list of priorities, that's up there. You know, Bill Clinton, President of the United States, you know, maybe, I don't know, the owner of Exxon says, listen, you've got a chance to get a grant for $500 billion. You could use that for anything you want for the Jewish people, but I need you to read this letter first. So I, you know, don't take this personally. I might actually push off my class to read this letter. All right, okay. In fact, if I know that I could get $500 billion, and I know how much good I could do with $500 billion, can you imagine how many children you could feed with $500 billion? Can you imagine how many people you could clothe? Can you imagine how many lives you could save? How many transplants? $500 billion? What could be more important than that? And then this guy walks by a little later, and he sees me, right? And I'm on the phone. He's like amazed. Who am I talking to? I'm talking to a good buddy to see when we can go out for dinner. Where do you have the gall? Or I'm sitting on the curb and I'm reading a comic book. So you could say that that's the way I interpret that verse. This should be you day and night. This is your recipe for the existence of the universe, for the meaning of your existence, for the purpose of life. Every moment of your life should be occupied with this. And your question shouldn't be, when should I find time to learn, but do I have the right, the legitimate obligation to remove myself from the study of Torah? Where do I get the gall to watch television? That's one way to look at it. Now, I'm not going to tell you that's wrong, because it's not wrong, it's right. But now that I finished telling you it's right, I'll tell you why it's not right. I didn't say it's wrong. It's not right. How do I know it's not right? Because there's another thing, and this thing is called halakha, Jewish law. Halakha, we'll get to halakha, we're going to discuss halakha. We're going to look at halakhic books, how I find out what to do. But let's call for the moment the halakha my guide to practical Jewish living. In other words, great, there's an obligation to study Torah. How do I do that? Where do I do that? When do I do that? Should I study Torah in the bathroom? Should I study Torah when I'm jogging? Should I be thinking a Mishnah thought as I'm diving into the pool? Like, how do I know when, how, what? How do I know when I've studied enough? Can I ever go to sleep? I mean, if I slept 8 hours last night. If I slept 8 hours last night, right? So, you and I both know that if I slept 7 hours and 55 minutes, it wouldn't make a difference in my day. That means I gave up 5 minutes of Torah. Well, how can I give up 5 minutes of Torah? And if I slept 7 hours and 50 minutes... So I know also I could function just as well. Could you ever look at any given moment of time and say, I can't live without that minute? So how could you ever stop learning Torah? Now the Gaon of Vilna, who I mentioned this morning, never slept 2 hours. I guess that was his perception. Me, I'm not on that level. So I look at the halacha. Now if the halacha tells me, I got to tell you, if the halacha tells me, if Jewish law tells me that's how you have to think, then I got a problem because that's how I have to think. I have to find a way to think that. But that's, thank God, not what the halacha tells me. Halacha says, how do you fulfill this obligation? Because it's not real. You don't expect every person in the world to be studying 22 hours a day. somebody has to run the phone company. Somebody has to run the gas station. There's no gas station. There's no cars. There's no cars. We can't get the class. We can't get the class. We can't learn Torah. So somebody has to run the gas station. So thank God the rabbis were brilliant and they understood, let's not be idiots. If we tell everybody to learn all the time, there'll be no food because somebody has to go out in the field and cut the wheat. And yet, if there's an obligation to study Torah, yomam v'layla, day and night, everybody has to do it. So listen to what Halacha says. Halacha says, day and night means just that, a moment of your day and a moment of your night. Now this is incredible. Because what does this mean? This means that if I can find a moment of time in my day and a moment of time in my night to study Torah, then I've grabbed that opportunity. And you could argue that the more time of day I study and the more time of night that I study, the more I've grabbed an opportunity, but that's not what I'm talking about right now. So if I find a minute in my day and a minute in my night, I fulfilled this incredible opportunity to study Torah, develop a relationship with Torah, develop a relationship with God. I want you to know something. There's a whole philosophy here. Real accomplishments in life, real accomplishments, are not let's do it all now and keep doing it until we get it. Real accomplishments are, is there something that I can do constantly, gradually, to achieve something? Take, for example, exercise. So a guy looks in the mirror one day, right, and he finds he's like this. And he's looking back and he sees, you know, it's not working. He says, I've got to get into shape. So what does he do? Calls up his boss, says, let him take the day off. Goes to Jack LaLanne, or I don't know, whatever, Lane Powers. I don't know, do the guys go to Lane Powers? No? So where did the guy go today?
Gold's.
Gold's, okay. Gold's Gym. So he goes to Gold's Gym, shows up in the morning, 9 a.m., says, okay, make me a man, right? Shows up, great. Puts in the whole day, does 9,000 push-ups, 1,500 chin-ups. You know, he's running around all day, 20 hours, yom v'layla, day and night. Finishes his day, sees he's not there yet. Does it the next day. Same thing, 15 hours, unbelievably pushing himself, right? Third day, he's in the hospital. It's not real. So the guy says, listen, take a chill pill. Instead of coming each day for 20 hours, show up for 20 minutes. What's 20 minutes? What's 10 minutes? Nothing. Show up for 20 minutes a day. For a month, you'll see a difference. That's real. You can't learn 10 hours a day. It's very hard. You can reach a level where you can learn 10 hours a day, but if you try to learn 10 hours a day tomorrow, you'll already mind. Of course, I say that at the beginning of the 3-week program, but there's a difference between struggling on your own and struggling in the program. We take it slow. I think it's a very healthy thing. There's a reason we don't start the second 3-week program right after the first 3-week program. Because you will see, you need a week to get some air. Now, why do I tell you all this? Because I think this is the most fundamental rule into how to develop a relationship with Torah. Let's say that there are 3 units in Torah. Do you know why so many people never get the prophets? Because they think they first have to finish Torah. So many people never get to study Maimonides because they think they have to finish Talmud. What if you did something different? What if you said that 10 minutes a day, 10 minutes a day, you would study some Torah. Not a lot. And 10 minutes a day, you would study some prophets. And 10 minutes a day, you would study one of the Psalms. I'll tell you that 2 things would happen. First, if you found the right way to study it, you wouldn't be able to study it for only 10 minutes. I'm telling you now. Wouldn't be able to study it for only 10 minutes. Eventually, it's at 15, 20, an hour. Second of all, you'd get somewhere in all 3 of them. As a matter of fact, when I was in Yeshiva, so I had X amount of time I spent on Talmud, and X amount of time I spent on Mishnah, and X amount of time I spent on Halacha, and X amount of time I spent on Rambam, and X amount of time I spent on Torah, and X amount of time I spent on prophets, X amount of time I spent on ethics, X amount of time I spent on prayer. And you look at your day, and it's like all compartmentalized, but then you look back after a few years, you realize, look how far I got. Tremendous feeling. I want to tell you something else. Somebody came to Rav Yisrael Salanter, who was the founder of the Musar movement, movement of ethics. Said to him, you know, I know it's a mitzvah, you have to study a lot of Torah. What if I only have a half an hour a day to study? What should I study? Good question. Half an hour, so many different things to study. Rav Yisrael Salanter said, study Jewish ethics. Because if you study Jewish ethics for a half an hour a day, you'll realize you have a lot more than half an hour a day. So that's the first stage in Torah study. If you want to develop a relationship with this book, you can't do it in drips and drabs. Very hard. Can you set for yourself a goal to take what we do in the next 3 weeks and to do it on your own for 5 minutes a day? Maybe to do it with a partner for 5 minutes a day. Tremendous idea. Now you don't know yet what it is. But that's number one. Having said that, what's the next stage? How do I do that? What do I do with that 5 minutes? What do I do with that 10 minutes? So I would tell you two things. First of all, in terms of this book, okay, I'm going to give you a suggestion that's a little bit strange. Don't start with the book of Genesis. Or I should say, don't start with the portion of Genesis. Do something very different. I heard this from a great, great master of Torah, who said this to a student that he had, Rabbi Rizkin, who said this to a student that he had. And I have found that this works very well. Because people always want to know where to start. Where's the logical place to start? The first verse. The first verse is Breshit bara Elokim et hashamayim et haaretz. God created the heavens and the earth. If you look at some of the commentaries on this verse, they're 20 and 30 pages. Because I have to understand who is God and what is creation. So you're all excited. You're going to do a verse a day. 6 months later, you're still on the first verse. Certain types of people can handle that. Most people can't. So I'll give you a suggestion. Instead of taking verse by verse, take it unit by unit. The Torah is divided up into units, stories. I have the story of Adam and Eve. That's a magnificent story. So goal number one is the story of Adam and Eve. When I feel I've gotten into the story of Adam and Eve and I'm ready to move on. So on the other hand, I realize how little I know about that story, but that's okay. Because the first stage is familiarity with the stories. If somebody mentions to my daughter, who's 7 years old, the name Avraham, she knows who Avraham is. Could she explain to you the philosophical underpinnings of the development of monotheism? No. But it would be inconceivable to her that a 7-year-old wouldn't know who Avraham is. Who's Yitzchak? Who's Yaakov? Who's Yosef? What's the burning bush? What's the story of Samson? What's the story of Jericho when Joshua entered the land? That's the first thing to do, is to work with the stories. And there are a lot of portions in the Torah that are not stories. There are portions, for example, of halakha, of Torah, of law. For example, there are whole portions like Mishpatim that deal with law after law after law, and it's a tremendous challenge to learn them. First, get down the basic stories. That's stage number one. When you've gotten down the stories, then you can work on the different mitzvot, on the different laws. And when you've gotten a sense of those, then you can go back and start to go through one at a time. Those are the three stages. Stories, and then the mitzvot. For example, there's a mitzvah in the middle of Deuteronomy when you go to war, how you behave when you go to war. It's not a story. But that's a unit of X number of verses that contains a couple of mitzvot, of opportunities, of halachot, of mitzvot. And you can study them. But first, go with the stories. The same thing, by the way, for the prophets. Prophecies, magnificent prophecies. Before I get to the prophecies of the dry bones and of the rebuilding of the temple, first of all, who is Ezekiel? Who were the kings of Judah? What's the story of King Ahab and Jezebel? Now, having said that, and I hope you're following me here because I'm really giving you a synopsis, now let's go back to Torah. What can I do with Torah? So now I'm going to give you a few stages. And there are two sides to this coin. One side to this coin is some of the technical skills that are appropriate to begin with, and I don't know your levels, but at least there's a range that are appropriate to begin with from day one, that don't take years to develop, but hours. Side number two, right, is how do I go from study of text to study of commentary? And which commentaries? And when do I study commentaries? You understand those two sides? So let's look at side number one. Side number one is a couple of skills that are worthwhile developing in terms of Torah study. And you're going to get a sense of this as we do Chumash. This will be a little more difficult when we get to, for example, the Siddur, prayers, because we're not going to be studying prayer regularly here, this program, right? But okay. Side number one, and we actually did this today, whether you realize it or not. Stage number one is I look at a text. What is the most important thing to do when I look at a text? And really what you're doing is you're choosing a text. So what's the most important thing to do when I choose a text is to break it down, right? Torah does this to me. I've got this whole book. Torah breaks it into three units, right? Five books, prophets, writings. Torah says, you know what, that's too much. How do you look at a unit of five books? Let's break it down further. We got five books. Genesis, Exodus, whatever. So you say, okay, I'm going to start with the stories in Genesis. That makes sense. So you say, okay, how do I break that down? So I've got different portions. Every book has portions. Genesis, Noah. We'll start studying Torah. If you do this, yours will be the earth. When you want to study Torah, take a portion and just read through the English. Don't learn it. Read through it. What are you doing when you read through a portion? Take, for example, I don't know, a portion of Genesis. Okay? So the portion of Genesis, if you have a Chumash, starts on page 1 and ends on lower half of page 6. Okay? With the beginning of Noah. 5.5 pages in this book. Right? So I'm going to read through this in English. What am I going to do when I read through this? I'm going to break it into units. So let's do that, because I want you to get a sense of what I'm talking about here. Okay? Alright? Look at the first page. Okay? We're on page 1. First page, creation of the world. Okay? Where does this unit end? Where does this unit end? Creation of the world.
7 days.
7 days. So find me the end of the first unit.
Chapter 2.
Pardon?
Beginning of chapter 2.
Right? Because I look at the end of verse 31. God saw everything he did. Now, that's not entirely true. How many days did God create the world in?
Six.
Mm-hmm. Now that's an interesting debate. That's actually a Catholic Jewish debate. The Catholicism controlled the printing presses when they came out. And the first Bibles, even the King James Bible, which became the major version of the Bible because that's what King James wanted, which is why it's called the King James Bible, assumed that at the end of 6 days, God finished creating the world. And then God rested. That's not the Jewish perception at all. Jewish perception is it took God 7 days to create the world. We talked about numbers last program, but the number 6 is never complete. It's always missing something. It's always missing that 7th. 6 is an incomplete number. You will never find 6 as a complete number. In fact, that's why 12 is also always an incomplete number. You will never find the number 12 complete. 12 tribes become 13. 2 of the tribes are Manasseh and Ephraim, the sons of Joseph. Joseph, the one, becomes 2. I have 13 tribes with Levi. Nobody knows that. They think they're 12 tribes. They're really 13. Even a girl who becomes bat mitzvah at 12 doesn't become bat mitzvah at 12. She becomes bat mitzvah at 12 and a day, the beginning of the 13th year. Now, why it is that a girl becomes bat mitzvah much, much earlier than a boy, that's an interesting question. It has to do with the fact that a girl is ready to accept more earlier than a boy. People forget that when they're looking at Judaism and thinking about all the problems that exist, which are there. But anyway, so in fact, my first unit is the 7 days of creation. Shabbat is a creation. God created something. It's called Shabbat. I'm not going to translate that for the moment because that's too difficult to translate. It's not just rest. But okay, those of you who were here last program, you got a chap. If you know you're not going to be here another program and you want to hear what I have to say on Shabbat, come over, bug me, we'll get a group together. I'll be glad to sit with you. So that's my first unit. What's my second unit? This is really easy. It's not so difficult to do. I read through my second unit and I find that the second unit seems to be a repeat of the first unit. God's creating the world again. How does that work? So I don't yet know what it is. I'm not interested in what it is. I'm not interested in the questions and learning it. I'm just interested in breaking it down. So my second unit starts at verse 4. Okay? And it goes right until verse 15. Some form of creative description. All of a sudden I look at verse 15 and I see God takes man, puts him in the Garden of Eden. And God says him to eat. And the tree of knowledge. And God says it's not good that he be alone. I'm going to make him woman. And God creates woman. Where does the creation of woman end? Well, the creation of woman ends, really, at the end of verse 25. The relationship between man and woman. They were both naked, man and his wife, not embarrassed, whatever that means. Then I have a new unit, chapter 3. The snake and the story of the tree. And that goes right up until the end of verse 21. And 22 to 24 is a subunit, but included in there, and then I get to verse 4. Chapter 4. In other words, I can break this down into units. In fact, if you look at the story of Breshit, it's about 5 units. That's really the whole first book. Now I've got 5 units. And I've written them down. Unit number 1, verse X to Y. And this is what I think that unit is. Now the more I learn, the more I start to realize, wait a second, I divided up the unit wrong. But I've got something to work with now. So I say, okay, I'm going to take a look at the first unit. First unit, 7 days of creation. You can decide to begin with that. Great. So you say, this is the first unit. And then you can go to the second unit, etc. Now what do? Now I need my first tool, which I've already used but haven't realized it. My first commentary. What's the first commentary I'm using as a tool to study Torah? Translation. We think that there's a commentary and there's a translation. It's not true. Translation is a commentary. It's the commentary of the person who wrote the translation. This English is a commentary on these verses. That's why you look at different translations and you will find different words. So I want to give you just as a clue, depending on how much you're willing to work. And it's very important when you study Torah to know what are your realistic expectations. So obviously, you're better off if you can learn Hebrew. And the more Hebrew you know, the easier it is. And it could be that while you're learning, you can attempt to grab a word a day, pick one word, to look it up, to think about it, to realize what it means, to find out where else it appears. To learn that word, if you do that and you're studying every day, after a year or so, you'll know enough Hebrew to learn it in Hebrew. That's just an aside. But that's a pretty heady goal, not easy, and not everybody has time to go to Ulpan and look up dictionaries. There's another way to do it. The other way to do it, at least to prevent yourself from having as much commentary, is to read more than one translation. Every time I see that three translations translate something the same way, I know that that's more or less the translation. When I see three translations, and there are three different words in three different translations, I know that this is a commentary, and I've got to think about that. What does it mean? Let's say you're not prepared to do that much work, because that's a lot of work. So you don't. So now you're using a commentary. And that commentary is a translation. I want to tell you this is one of the best translations I know of. This Bible is called the Koren Tanakh, not to be confused with Koran, which is the Islamic Bible. The Koren Tanakh. It has all three sets. It's a pretty good working English translation with no other commentary besides the translation. It's very well broken up. So, I work with the translation. I want to give you a piece of advice. Before I get to the next stage, which is what other commentaries we can use, I want to tell you, you would be perfectly within good ground to not go to any other commentary until I spent a lot of time working with Torah just in translation. And I'll tell you why. When I study the Torah through a commentary, I'm not really studying the Torah. The commentary is. And I'm studying it through the commentary's eyes. One of the differences between translation and commentary is that the translation is an attempt to bring you as objective a picture of something as it can. Whereas a commentary, as opposed to a translation, doesn't do that. Commentary is interested in presenting you a very subjective picture. So you're still worth beginning with a translation. You will find many different translations. You may find that the translation that I like isn't the one you like. For example, one of the things about this translation is very thou thee, you know? Thou hast said unto me. There's a working translation by Aryeh Kaplan called The Living Torah. Also, a magnificent translation. It also has actually commentary underneath. It's a great volume to get. If you're going to get only this volume, you might be better off with only that volume. Although that's only the five books. Now let's say I've gotten this far. And let's say that I've been doing this now for a month or two, and I've been working on the English, and I've done this breaking down. By the way, you know what you do when you finish breaking down your portion into units? Well, you can break your unit down into units. I'll give you an example. If you look at the story of Abraham and the binding of Isaac. So that's a unit. It's in verse chapter 22 of Genesis. It's a unit of the binding of Isaac. But I break that unit down into units. First is where God comes to Abraham, commands him to go. And then is where Abraham actually goes, and they're going. And then there's a certain point in the story where Isaac says to Abraham, what's going on? And that's a separate unit. And then I have what happens after that conversation. So I can break it down into units and analyze a section. And the more I can break something down, the more it's manageable. You understand what I'm saying? Let's say I've done that. And I've taken the translation, and I've broken it down. And I've read it through. And I've got a sense of it. Now we begin to learn. How do I learn? So I want to tell you there are two very important stages of learning. One of the I alluded to this morning. What's the first stage in real learning? I mentioned this morning. A good question. And I want you to know how I used to learn. And I still do sometimes. Make a list. Make a list of all the things you can find that bother you. Everything. If you're reading a portion, like, I don't know, the binding of Isaac, and you have a list and you don't have 15 questions on it, you're missing something. I can make you a list of 50. And the more questions you have, the more you're learning it. And that's very important. And that list of questions has to be before you as long as you choose to pursue that. And I want to tell you a couple more things. Don't assume, because what's the next stage once I've got a list of questions? What do I do then?
Find the answer.
How do I find the answer? It's kind of a problem, right? So I want to tell you what people naturally assume. Well, now we're up to the commentaries, right? I got my resource books, right? So I look up my Rashi, or my Rambam, or my Ramban, my different rabbinical commentaries, geniuses no doubt, and see if they answer the question. Now, that's a very valid perception. But it's a huge mistake to be there already. You know the first place that I have to look for answers, and I cannot tell you how crucial this is, and I cannot tell you how many people when they learn Torah don't do this. It's just mind-boggling to me. I always took it for granted until I started to meet students who didn't even realize you should do this. The first commentary that you have to look at is right up here. That's the most important commentary. What do I think? Now you have to do that with a certain amount of humility. You could be wrong. You could be basing your perception on something which is completely incorrect. You could be unaware of other texts. So you have to find a way to check what you think, and we'll get to that. But that's the next stage. What do I think? If I say to myself, you know, and perhaps I should preface this, there are different types of questions. It's important to be aware of different types of questions, because as I come up with different types of questions, I begin to realize that different commentary deal with responses to different types of questions and different types of answers. I'll give you an example. Let's say, for example, that I see in a verse that the same word is repeated twice. Or I see in a chapter that the same verse is repeated twice. So that's very interesting. Why does it have to be repeated? I already know this. Or let's say I find things that are superfluous in the text. Okay? So we'll call that a question of textual repetition. Let's say I have another question, a question of context. What is this particular item doing next to this item? You find this a lot, for example, in halachot, in laws. Right? At the end of the story of Sinai, all of a sudden I find a mitzvah to let the land lie fallow in the seventh year. What does that have to do with what's going on? Why is the law of a Hebrew slave, this is actually our last class in the course that I was teaching this morning, why is the first thing that God tells us as a mitzvah after Sinai, the laws of slavery? It's so strange. So it's a question of context. Nobody's asking whether there's a value to the law. They're just saying, what's that law doing here? Sometimes I have a context of stories. Especially in the prophets. Okay. Rashi very often deals with questions of context. If you find a blatant contextual question, how does the end of this relate to the beginning of that? Very often Rashi will deal with it. The more I study Rashi, the more I begin to note that he's the one who's answering that question. The more I get a sense that when I have that type of question, that's where I'm going to look. If I have a linguistic question, the Ibn Ezra, he's into that. So I get a sense that that's a place to look. So it doesn't matter who deals with what. But the more I study and take note of these things, the more I begin to get a sense of who does what. There are philosophical questions. How could God ask Abraham to kill his son? You will very rarely find that Rashi deals with that type of question, unless you know how to read it between the lines. The Abarbanel, on the other hand, ooh, that's his forte. Maimonides in the Guide to the Perplexed, that's why he wrote the book. So knowing where to look can be very valuable. I want to tell you a second thing. And I can't stress the importance of this. So I got a good question. How long should I try to find an answer? I got a good question. I can't think of a good answer. What do I do? Or I can't find one in the commentaries. I want you to know one of the things you learn from studying Torah is patience. We have this perception that every question has to have an answer. That I have to get the answer. And that's not true. Because a good question is valuable whether I find the answer or not. I want to tell you on occasion, I'll have a question, and that question will be with me for years, until I'm studying something totally differently, and all of a sudden I realize, because I've reviewed that question so many times, this is the answer to that question. I remember one particular time, I was studying Talmud and Yeshiva, with a chavruta, with a study partner, and we were studying a Gemara, and I suddenly said, oh, that explains it. And he couldn't figure out what I was talking about, because we hadn't asked the question. But I was thinking of a different Talmudic discussion that had always bothered me, and that every time I reviewed it, and of course you can't do this type of thing unless you review, that every time I reviewed it would always bother me, and eventually I found the answer. You can find the answer to a question you asked 10 years ago. That's what our lives are about. So the value of a good question, and by the way, you know how you know if a question is really a good question? If it stays with you. and vice versa. If you want it to be a question that you find an answer, you have to keep it with you. So that's very valuable. So it's very important to do those two things, to get a sense of the story, to find out what bothers you, to see what perceptions you come up with, what really your perception is. And I'll tell you why. Sometimes I'll read a commentary, and a commentator will say something. He won't tell you the question. Rashi, for example, will be explaining something, but you won't know what his question is. But because you've asked the question yourself, you realize this is his answer to my question. So you've clued into something that you wouldn't have gotten if you just read Rashi. And then, of course, you get to the next stage, which is, well, now that's interesting, because that's definitely the answer to my question, but he didn't give my answer. Why not? I can't imagine Rashi didn't think of my answer, so what bothered him? Is there something I'm missing? Now you're learning. Learning is like salad. You got to toss it and turn it, chew it. If you look at my son eat salad, spit it out. You know, whatever it might be. So now that brings me to the next stage. Now I've got this perception. I've got a story. I've broken it down. I've got an idea of questions. I may come up with more questions as I'm learning and write them down on my question list. And now I want to go beyond this. I want to tell you, by the way, that this is the point that you can take one of two directions. Again, this is all my opinion. This is the way I learn. You can take one of two opinions. It could be, and I don't have an answer to this. You have to find what works for you. It could be that this process alone, which is not an easy process, it's a lot of work, it's a lot of fun, it's a lot of work, that this process is enough of a process to occupy you on a given story, and then you're ready for a new story. And that's how you learn. And of course, by the way, when I say an answer, I don't just mean a technical answer. I also mean, what does this mean to me? Have I learned something from this story? Because if you haven't learned anything from the story, then you definitely haven't learned it. What is the binding of Isaac? What does that teach me about self-sacrifice? About my relationship with Hashem and my relationship with the next generation and defining the real purpose of life and everything else that I can possibly think of. So that's one way to do it, is to go from story to story and to put this process. I have to add an additional component, which we're going to discuss tomorrow. That's the concept of chavruta. The verse in Proverbs says, and I think this is so true, for everything in life, tovim hashnayim min ha'echad. Two is better than one. Ki binpol ha'echad, because when one falls, he falls alone. But when one falls in a partnership, the other one can pick him up. Learning is a very difficult thing. It's easy when you're here and you're in a program with someone else. I mean, this isn't real learning, I'll be honest with you. This is entertainment. Think about it. Tomorrow we're going to do a little bit of real learning. But this is entertainment. I'm entertaining you. Maybe I'm not entertaining you, but that's the theory. Right? Real learning is me struggling. Me sitting alone at the end of a hard day's work. You know, it's no big... I always think, you know, people think, wow, yeshiva guy, he's sitting on today, thank God, yeshiva women. So, you know, a woman goes to yeshiva, a guy goes to yeshiva, and they sit 10 hours a day, 12 hours a day, learning Torah all day. It's unbelievable. Wow, call it, my hat's off to you. Not true. I spent years in yeshiva, it's not true. It's no big deal. You're in yeshiva, of course, what are you going to do? Of course you're going to learn. I'll grant you, some people learn more, some people learn less. Are you kidding me? It's like being impressed that somebody goes swimming in the pool when you're in day camp. That's no big deal. If you were in my yeshiva and Rav Lichtenstein stood up to give a class, how could you not go to the class? If you knew Rav Lichtenstein was, come out! But if you're working on Wall Street, and you get home at the end of a difficult day and it's 7 o'clock and the kids are there and you have supper and you put it to bed and it's 9 o'clock at night and your eyes are falling out of your head, and you sit down for 10 minutes and you study Torah, now that's Torah. That's not easy. That's very hard. Coming to a lecture in Israelite, that's easy. I'll be honest with you. Somebody misses Rabbi Cardoza's lecture, I don't ask somebody where they were. Because I can't imagine that anybody would miss Rabbi Cardoza's lecture and not have a good reason for it. Because why would you? You'd be nuts. But if there's a lecture at the synagogue, 20 blocks away, and it's 9 o'clock at night, and you remember that there's a lecture at 9 o'clock at night, you got to get in your car and run over there and put back your pants and whatever it is. So that's a lot of effort. And it's late at night and you're tired. That's real learning. Doing that alone is very, very difficult. In general, doing things alone is very difficult. Being alone for a while may be good because it teaches you to appreciate not being alone. So the real challenge is to find someone you can study with, to learn with. Because if I'm learning with someone else, then it's not a thought process. It's an argument. It's a discussion. It's a debate. Because I've got my opinion, and you've got your opinion, and maybe I'm right, maybe you're right. And here's my question, do you have an answer? And here's your question, do I have an answer? And maybe both of us have different answers. And maybe we're thinking about it and struggling with it, and we're saying it out loud. You go into yeshiva, you know what you hear? This is another incredible sound. You hear a roar. It's like a sea. You walk into yeshiva, Beis Medrash, and you'll see two people, and you think there's some terrible thing going on. Because they're studying Gemara, right? They're studying Chumash, they're studying whatever it is. What are you talking about? What are you talking about? Adam doesn't say that. Rashi doesn't say that. Rashi's like this. The guy says, no, it's not true. Look, the Ramban. Ramban says like this. What do you mean? Listen, look at the Ramban. The Ramban doesn't say that. And you see these people, and they get up, and they start to pace back and forth. And one guy says, listen, I'll tell you how Rashi understands this, because this is how the Gemara is understood. And if you look at it this way, and you look at it that way, and look at this page, and look at that page, and this is what it is. What are you talking about? And sometimes you get into it, you forget where you are, you're yelling and screaming, and two guys over here, and there's two guys there on a different topic. And they're yelling and screaming over there. And I went to yeshiva, there were 500-600 guys. And it was like a roar. And somebody comes in as a visitor and stands up and doesn't know what the heck is wrong with all these people. But if you're learning Torah like this, then you're not living it. When I finish learning, so I work up a sweat. I developed a relationship with it. Nobody plays tennis by taking up a ball, throwing it across the net. Another person picks it up and says, here you go. Right? You gotta struggle with it. If you find someone to do this with, then it's incredible. And then you go to the next stage. We have only two more minutes, and that's the stage of commentaries. Now I gotta be honest with you. You gotta be sure you're ready for the next stage and you're comfortable with it. And we're gonna really, the reason I didn't leave too much time for commentaries here is because this is really gonna come up over the course of the course on Chumash that we're studying. But I will tell you that people make a mistake. People automatically assume that the way to go is Rashi. It's not so simple to study Rashi. How does Rashi work? Why does Rashi quote this and not that? Sometimes Rashi explains things, sometimes he doesn't. Sometimes you don't know why Rashi says what he says. It's a challenge. So I want to tell you something. Studying Rashi isn't getting an answer to my question. It's finding new questions. Rav Shlomo Yitzchaki was a medieval commentator, lived in the Middle Ages in France and Germany. He was one of those brilliant commentators we ever had. He wrote a commentary on the entire Bible. When I say Bible, I don't mean the five books. I mean the whole thing. He wrote a commentary on the entire Talmud. Do you know what that means? He died, by the way, at age 65. Incredible mind. And he was very cryptic. And you have to understand what he's saying and why he's saying it and how he's trying to do it. So you read a Rashi and you say, well, why is Rashi saying this? How does Rashi work? I study Rashi on a lesser degree like I study the Torah. What do I think Rashi is saying? What do you think Rashi is saying? What are my questions on Rashi? What are your questions on Rashi? And then I go to other commentaries. So I want to tell you the greatest challenge is to find a commentary or two that you can fall in love with. If you've studied a commentary for 2-3 weeks and you feel, you know what, it doesn't do it for me, then find another one. Now, I have never found a commentary that doesn't do it for me, but I definitely have my favorite commentaries because they deal with the types of questions that I love to ask. They must have thought, or I must think, like they do to a certain degree. So I have a relationship with those commentaries. I love Rashi. I think Rashi is incredible. I have great difficulty with Ibn Ezra. Ibn Ezra, Rabbi Abraham Ibn Ezra, also a medieval commentator. Very difficult, very cryptic. I have a friend, he's a mathematical whiz. He loves anagrams and geometric roots and all these sorts of things. Calculus. And that's really Ibn Ezra. Ibn Ezra is very into mathematical puzzles, all sorts of things like that. And, you know, he'll say, the real answer to this is 33 verses from here. And then you look at another verse, and you don't understand what it has to do with anything, and you can't figure things out. And all sorts of questions like that, puzzles and riddles, and philosophical ideas. So he loves the Ibn Ezra, because the Ibn Ezra to him is a kindred spirit. So I'll be honest with you. On purpose, although we're going to mention a few, we're going to talk about 6, maybe 7 different commentators through the next few weeks in Bible, which is an incredible amount. Because you could spend years just going through one commentary on the Bible. And that's your challenge. When you feel you're ready for it, then you find one commentary that you can relate to. To do that, I will tell you a few things.
How many commentaries
are there out there? Oh, thousands. Lots. You could fill a book. As a matter of fact, if you want to get a picture of it, and I purposely took this out, this is an incredible book. It's called The Great Torah Commentators. Gives you the basic ones, right, on different types of texts. So, for example, I think it lists here Seven or eight? No? Yeah, whatever. Some old, some new of the basic commentaries, which are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, about 17 or 18. And it'll give you, for example, if this is Rashi, so this is a picture of Rashi, right? This is a description of who Rashi was. This is an example of what the Rashi text looks like in the Hebrew, a translation of some of his comments. So you get a sense of who Rashi was. This is a tremendous book. Now I want to tell you the greatest tragedy that happens here at Israelite, and I promise you it'll happen with some of you. And you'll be legitimate to let it happen because there's so much else going on. Is that there's a whole library here. And there's all this stuff at your fingertips. You don't have to go buy it. You can just peruse it. Don't let it pass you by. I personally took this out and put it up here. Take a look at it. I'll leave it on the desk for now. My request, by the way, don't take it out of the Beit Midrash so other people can look at it. But you can take a look at this book today, tomorrow, whenever. It sits here. If it's not here, it's usually in that shelf over there. Right? This is the commentary of the Ramban. And I like to give people tools to do on their own what they don't need me to do. You can look up the Ramban in this book, tell you who he is. And then you can go to this book, which is in the volume back there, and you can study the Ramban. Now we're studying Exodus. So you can take one of the stories of Exodus that we've been looking at, and you can study the Ramban in English, and get a sense of whether he's for you or not, whether you like it or not. Now there's years of study in the Ramban. But just as an idea, you can open up this one. This is a linear translation of Rashi. Which means that what it does is, instead of like giving you a paragraph and a paragraph, it actually translates Rashi line for line. So it's very easy to see what's going on here. It does the same thing with the verses. It's a great Bible to have if you want to also start to get the hang of the Hebrew. Because it also has vowels. So this can give you a sense of Rashi. If we're in Exodus, and we're studying stories, you know, that's interesting. We studied something today. We learned about it. I have my questions. We didn't get to all my questions in class. I want to play around with this. So you know what? I'm going to grab a friend, and I'm going to spend half an hour in the afternoon or tonight or whatever. We'll study this the way we were talking today. And then you finish that. You've got your questions. You've got your answers. You've got your debate, whatever it might be. You do it over lunch. So you know what? I'm curious. I want to see what a commentary has to say. Rashi, the Ramban, whoever it might be. So it's sitting at your fingertips. This is also back there in the corner in Bible, right? Okay? This is the Torah Tamima. Torah Tamima of Baruch Epstein. So I'll talk to him about him at a certain point. But what he does is he brings down every Talmudic comment on a particular verse. So I can see what the Talmud, which is a commentary much older than these, has to say about these verses. This is a book, incredible book. This is by Yehuda Nachshoni. It's called Studies in the Weekly Parsha. Right? There's always somebody who says, well, how do I do this? Or I want to look up a Devar Torah, or I want to try to come up with a thought of my own. And what he does, something totally different. He's not interested in going verse by verse. He takes a topic, and he gives you literally a sermon on the topic. And then you can take what he has to say, and the authorities that he quotes, and you can play around with it, and think about it, and debate it. For example, right, this particular one that I have here is Bamidbar. So for example, if I look at the portion known as Shalach, which contains the story of the spies, he's got a whole discussion on the spies' mission. He's got a discussion on the mitzvah of tzitzit. He's got a discussion here on the mitzvah of teaching Torah to the children of other people, etc., etc., right? And he sets it up in paragraphs and units. Tremendous. Okay? The last one that I wanted to show you. Oh, well, there's a couple more. So, this is something called the Midrash Says. So I don't have time to go on what Midrash is. There are a few students here who were here in the last program. We covered Midrash in the Jewish books, right? So they are your resident experts on Midrash, right? It'll force them to go through what they should go through anyway. So ask them, right? You can ask Lisa, right? You can ask Ora. You can ask, who else was here last program?
Esther.
Oh, okay. Esther, right? And at least, you know, you'll get a start. Like, if you can't catch me, you'd be amazed, by the way, at what tools you all have at your fingertips in each other. But that's another discussion. So you look at the Midrash. And the Midrash will give you all of the rabbinic legends on that particular portion of the week, or some of the major ones. This is Nechama Leibovich, the woman that I mentioned this morning. Incredible. She divides up the portion into units, right? This is, for example, Exodus. So, you know, one is the introduction to the whole book of Exodus. She has one on the story of the thorn bush. She has one on the elders slipping out. She has one on the Ten Commandments. She has one on, you know, whatever it might be, right? Now, this I want you to know is advanced stuff. But nobody ever got burnt from studying something they weren't ready for. And you study this, and she has a section at the end of each section called Questions for Further Study. She doesn't give answers. You've got to do that yourself. Can you come up with an answer? Tremendous idea, right? That should give you enough of a picture of how much is at your fingertips. So now make use of it while you're here, or later, or whatever you want. But at least I feel you've got the inkling of an idea of where you could begin, a direction you could take, which I think is important. Now, I don't want anybody to misunderstand this. There are so many beautiful things to study and so many wonderful things to do with our lives. It's not for me to say that you should now tonight begin to study Torah. Matter of fact, I would say tonight you should get a good night's sleep. But I do want to feel at the end of this program that for those who wish to pursue this, that at least I've given you the initial tools of what you could do. In other words, you could find someone and you could actually begin studying Torah on your own just by buying a Bible. And most people don't realize how easy it would be to start doing that. So whether you do that and what you do, that's up to you. I will tell you that for me, it's been incredibly fulfilling. And I will tell you, by the way, one last thing. There is no greater gift that you can give to your children than to begin studying your Jewish heritage. My daughter comes home from school. Okay, so granted, she's in a school where she's studying these things, which is another question. And I have what to say to her. And I can study with her. I had a student once, 45-year-old woman, and she came here, and we were talking, and I asked her once, you know, what motivated her to come? And she said, my daughter was in Hebrew school. And my daughter asked me a question, and I didn't know the answer. And it just boggled my mind. How could I not have the answer from my daughter to a question like this, something so basic? So she decided, I got to start learning about this. I have to say, I have tremendous admiration for this person, along with some people in this room. Because it's easy to start doing this when you're 25. Do it when you're 50. It's not so easy. People who come here and say, you know, even at 50, it's never too late. I've had students who come here at 70, tremendous. So today's the beginning of the rest of your life. What you do with it is up to you. Torah study is a question of the relative. Relative to what I did yesterday, do I feel that I'm moving forward today? Okay? I used to love to run. I got into a car accident. I can't run anymore. So now I bike ride. Baruch Hashem, right? I'm not a basketball player in the NBA, so it doesn't really matter to me. But if I would go back to running today and try to do what I was doing when I left off, I'd collapse. Not that I was Mr. Super Runner, but you know, I couldn't run 2 kilometers today without collapsing, right? If I ran 50 feet today, that'd be a lot better than what I did yesterday. If I did 50 feet every day for the next year, it'd be meaningless. Because you gotta see growth. Same thing with bike riding, same thing with everything else. Number one. Number two, I'll tell you an experiment that I started for a group in Pittsburgh. Because they were also, how do we do it, whatever. So I said, look, I'm here for X amount of time. I'll start something with you if you promise me that you'll continue it after I leave. It's great. So we met once a week. We picked a story. And I didn't give them a whole lecture on it. We just had a discussion. When you think about it, what we did today on the story of Joseph could easily have been a discussion, the same if we had enough time to do it. I sometimes do it as a lecture because we don't have the time. But we could be having a discussion about this if we had 3 hours. So that's what we did. We met once a week in somebody's home, and we had a discussion group. And we all read the particular story, and then we started to think about it, and we debated about it, and whatever it might be. And we came up with a lot of incredibly valuable lessons. That's a great way to study Torah. You know, it's a lot of fun. Somebody makes the popcorn. You know, it doesn't have to be, let's go to the synagogue and find the most boring individual on the face of the earth and just feel we're suffering, because then we feel we're gaining something. You know, it doesn't have to be that way. But you understand what I'm saying? Okay? I will tell you also that it's very easy to begin a habit like that in a place like this. So take advantage of that. If you find 5, 10, 15 minutes a day, and you're not in the program, and you're studying, at the end of 2 weeks, you will suddenly realize, wow, you know, I studied 15 minutes a day on my own, or with a friend. That was great. So it'll give you an idea whether that's for you or not.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.